The Tom Woods Show, episode 1218.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the state sucks the life out of education, and it's long past time to think about alternatives. Check out my free ebook, Education Without the State, over at nostateeducation.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking today about an interesting project laying out the legal principles on which a stateless society would be based. So this is for all you libertarians who are willing to take that final step and say, maybe we don't need to initiate any aggression whatsoever. What would that look like? And how would some of the hard questions be dealt with from a legal standpoint? That is the purpose of the Creative Common Law Project, which is the project of our guest today, Dr. Jamin Huebner. Dr. Huebner is a scholar, musician, and entrepreneur from South Dakota, where he serves as academic dean at John Witherspoon College. He's widely published and has got quite an interesting project here that you should definitely check out over at creativecommonlaw.com. Jamin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
All right. We have a big project of yours that we're going to talk about, and I'm not sure exactly where this is going to go, but I'm going to get the ball rolling and we'll just see what happens. The project is Creative Common Law. Can you explain what the purpose of it is?
Yes. Creative Common Law is a legal system for stateless societies. A lot of your listeners are familiar with the idea of private governance. And court systems, legal systems, transportation, rights protection services that are all privately owned. And this is one of a number of different projects in this space. The big difference is this is kind of the first time that, you know, some people have sat down and really hammered out what it would look like to have an articulation of property rights, non-aggression, and contract law in a way that's kind of turnkey ready for a group or a former nation state or whatever that wants to move in that direction. And so what's also a little bit distinctive about Creative Common Law, well, I mean, there's a lot of things that are distinctive, but I think one of the big ones is that it's explicitly based on the principle of non-aggression and property rights and things like that, which is not really the case with a lot of other projects, which is sort of interesting because I think if, you know, Murray Rothbard and other people were alive today, they would be really, really excited to see all the different kinds of projects going on, from seasteading to different cryptocurrency projects and so-called blockchain nations. And you had Tom Bell on not too long ago, and ULEX and BitNation and the technology and just all these different areas. This discussion is now part of regular and popular discourse. And you know, now there's two monographs out, one by Cambridge and another by Oxford, on this type of thing, like living without government. And so this isn't really a utopia anymore, and this is part of popular discourse. But the thing is there's a lot of confusion around it. Just because people talk about stateless nations or stateless societies in a world without politicians and things like that, doesn't mean they necessarily have anything to do with libertarian principles. A good indication of that, for example, is the BitNation project, which is sort of a competitor, but not really. It's mainly in the tech space and marketing, and it's an app that you can download on your phone today, and you can create your own nation. But it's sort of interesting how it works because it's like an oversight project that looks over any kind of nation you want to create. And in their white paper, they actually say, you can create a communist country if you want. Obviously, I don't think that's going to lead to the type of peace that they describe, and that you really can't have a free society when you have, you know, a monopolized economy, for example. And so Creative Common Law is specifically based on, you know, particular philosophical principles, but we're bridging that gap that's so necessary. Because we can argue about non-aggression and property rights until we're blue in the face, but until lawyers have something in their hands that they can use, some kind of articulation that they can use to actually prosecute crimes and aggressions, well, then all of our theory is sort of worthless as far as I'm concerned.
Now, given that you've, in fact, is it linkable, what you sent me? Because I've got the whole thing. Is that document available somewhere?
Yeah, the creativecommonlaw.com is the website. We have the latest draft, which is version 0.67. Version 1.0 will be complete, the first draft. And anyone can go on there and look at it. And honestly, this is something I've been working on for years. But what kind of spurred me along was the massive response of Trey Goff's little constitution document on Mises. It was like over 200 or 300 comments. And this was just like a 2 or 3 page document. And I'm like, wow, I mean, I know I can do better than this. And a lot of people, other people have too. I can't believe that no one has come to articulate something, you know, to this level, because we've been talking about it for so long. And so really the hope is to get more public input through comments and through, you know, it's a WordPress site, so you can comment on different updates and things like that. Since it's so new, this was just launched a few months ago. We haven't yet got that traffic, but I suspect we're going to get that. But we have a lot of interesting people involved, a lot of lawyers and others, mainly because that I'm not an attorney myself, so I need to rely on some others. But I've definitely been learning a lot as the process goes on. But yeah, everything is there on the website, and I explain. There's a Q&A section, what it is, what it would look like, and I mean. Like for some readers who have read that book by Edward Stringham on private governance, he gives the analogy throughout his book of, you know, in contrary to David Friedman, we don't have to imagine what a free society would look like. Freedom is everywhere. I mean, private governance is everywhere. It's in families, it's in businesses, it's in clubs, it's in organizations, it's in societies. It's everywhere. We don't have to pretend like, oh, what would a free society look like? I mean, we don't have to imagine that. So it's not really a theory. It's just, you know, because it's free markets and things are the default. It's a phenomenon of nature. It's not something that we have to impose upon the world. It's just kind of the way things go, you know, through spontaneous organization and things like that. So
let me jump in and ask a question. I think some people would look at something like this and say, isn't this superfluous? Why would a free society need, in effect, a constitution, even though that's not quite what this is? But, you know, more or less, this would be resolved by private parties and so on and so forth. But I presume that we would want something we could point to as a point of general understanding shared by everybody that mm-hmm. could inform our daily activities and inform our expectations.
That's right. And that's kind of the point. It is not a constitution, and it doesn't function like that. It functions as the terms of a contract, okay? Or it functions as the rules of a club or society. If you become a member of the American Economic Association, if you become a member of a country club, you're voluntarily entering that group and you're bound by their rules. You agree to adhere to them and to be under their disciplinary action. And there's different kinds of membership for different levels and different purposes. And that's just what it is. That's all that this is. It's the free society club. But the thing is when we're talking about a free society, we're talking about something that's scalable, something that's meant for the long haul, and something that applies to all your properties and to as many people as possible. And so we're talking about rules that apply 24/7. They apply to all of your property. And then they involve, of course, legitimate uses of force. And so it's just like a large scale voluntary society, which is what a free society would, I mean, by definition, that's what it is. So, but what this does is it actually establishes protocols, policies, and procedures that provide the necessary framework for how, say, for example, the enforcers interact with adjudicators, with judges or private arbiters, how all of that gets managed in a property record-keeping system, how different levels of membership apply. And this is some of the secret sauce of creative common law, is that there's 4 or 5 different levels of membership, which solve a lot of the notorious problems that are always in the journals and in the blogs. You know, well, what about, you know, abortion and children and children's rights? And what about for those who are mentally disabled? And what about criminals? What do we do with criminals? What rights do they have? All of this is addressed, unlike any other project of its kind, through membership. And so there's certain contingencies with each level of membership and things like that. So, and there's a lot of other differences. You know, I've read Benson and Stringham and Rothbard and all the different people in this space, and I've taken all of their work and kind of refined it into the best that I could. They don't always agree, but And then, of course, addressed issues that they just haven't yet that are really important. You know, like if you read Benson's book, The Enterprise of Law, is it an excellent book? I agree with the vast majority of it, but I think he's a little bit optimistic about how to manage prisons and prisoners and what that would look like and how to protect prisoners' rights to the extent that they have rights. If you read Stringham's books on private governance, he talks about membership. Well, we need to be pessimistic about all this and be realistic and say, well, people are going to want to block membership. They're going to want to preclude membership. And if you have a monopoly over membership of a voluntary society, you no longer have a kind of voluntary society that you want. So there's a lot of different issues that are ironed out in creative common law that haven't been in anything else. And that includes ULEX as well. Tom Bell's project is very similar to creative common law, probably the closest thing. But the biggest difference is, he kind of begins with existent legal systems like Uniform Commercial Code and the current contract law. It's basically a annotated bibliography. And he tries to then kind of start with all of that as it exists and then redefine some things where they appear to be contradictory and then sort of leave it at that, make some harmonizations. Creative common law is the other way around. We start with property rights, non-aggression, and contract law. We articulate those things in a way that is legally enforceable and that makes sense. And then it defaults to other legal systems, the commercial code or the tort law and product liability and things like that, where creative common law may be deficient. So, I mean, either way, they're both really great projects in that respect. And I have reasons for why I chose that approach and others, but I don't want to get ahead of this interview too much. But anyway.
All right. So let me try and articulate exactly what's going on here. What you have produced is something that is informed by the common law as we've understood it. That is to say, there are many, no doubt, principles that go back quite a long time in the history of Western civilization. But you've also informed it by theory, by libertarian theory. Mm-hmm. And now there's plenty of libertarianism that comes through in the ordinary course of the common law, but the common law is not For a New Liberty by Rothbard. Mm-hmm. So you've sharpened it a bit so as to clarify certain libertarian parameters, and the result is the creative common law.
Yeah, and you know, the name is probably slightly misleading in that respect because it's really – it's hard for me to say how much it really is launching off of British common law in that tradition that goes back all the way to the 1300s or whatever.
That just in the sense that libertarianism itself is derived in at least partly from, it's not like we just developed everything from whole cloth. We have some ideas that are shared in common by everybody, and then We just apply them really rigorously.
Right. Yeah. And that's true. So I guess,
In other words, what makes it common law then? So why do you use the term?
Well, mainly it's marketable, because people think of, creative commons, you know,
I like creative common law. Right. Yeah. That was exactly what I thought when I first saw it. I thought that was a nice play on words, but also it does sound like that's more or less what you're doing.
Well, it generally is, yes. But the thing though is, this is viewed as sufficient, right? So it's not like when adjudicators, judges, arbiters, and others are using this, that they're going to have to, you know, like ordinary lawyers or whatever, if they want clarification on some things, or if they want certain, I don't know, enforceability on certain things, they're going to go back to their library and they're going to look through this history of common law and these different things. The document itself is viewed as sufficient, and it defines all the different types of aggressions based on modern legal dictionaries.
I see.
And so it kind of starts there, and then, yeah, it's more modern in that respect.
Okay, so it doesn't conceive of itself as being part of an ongoing evolution, but rather...
Well, I mean, that's inevitably the case. I use the term plaintiff and defendant. Well, these are French terms that go a long ways back. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that stuff like that is there, but it's not explicitly, you know, having its origins and roots in that, even though it sort of does. That's just not necessary for interpretation or application of it. So, and it would probably cloud things because then there's going to be confusion about, you know, what has more weight than other things. And of course, if this is viewed as a contract, what matters is what's in the contract itself, if this is being enforced as a contract. So I don't know if that helps clarify things a little bit, but It is a unit.
I was going to ask, can you take one section of it on some topic and walk us through what we learn reading it?
I think I could. I can just describe the way the current draft is, and maybe I'll...
Yeah, because I'd like people to get the flavor. Now that sure. They get the contours of it, I'd like them to get the flavor of it.
Sure. There's four sections in the current draft, which is version 0.67. I hope to get version 1.0 done by about after Christmas. The first section is prolegomena, which is your first principles. So it says about creative common law. It says what this is. It's based on three theoretical foundations: property rights, contract law, and non-aggression. And then it talks about the text itself. And this is something, unfortunately, a lot of comparable projects don't do. They don't really talk about how translation can affect the legal process, and to the extent that translations of this are applicable, and how, for example, footnotes function and literary devices function, like et cetera, and example, because I provide a lot of examples. I want this to be, again, complete and workable in the hands of people. So I have to really flesh out some things, but then I have to, of course, say how these examples work. So then that's just kind of the introductory phase. And then I talk about hermeneutics and how it should be interpreted or can be interpreted and all that. Then we get into chapter 3 is on property rights. I basically define property rights very shortly, talk about riparian rights, which have to do with water passing through your land or space. And then something that's sort of innovative is a new application of riparian rights, which is atmospheric rights, which is that people have the right to have natural airflow beside or through their property. And this actually, I think, would take care of most of air pollution and all of that, but I don't have time to talk about that. And then there's spatial rights in the geospatial frontier, something in our world, now we have Trump launching Star Wars or whatever the heck it is, we're going to keep going up and up. And how is this going to work? How is homesteading going to work with orbits? How is, you know what I mean? There's these new questions that people didn't have to ask 100 years ago. I address all of that there. And then I talk about easements. And then we get into chapter 4, which is on liberty and aggression. And so here you have kind of the whole overhaul of crime. Like, what is a crime? What is illegal? And it's all based on aggression. But when you get to define these terms and you talk about the types, there's two major divisions. Personal aggression, which is initiating force against a person. Or property aggression, which is against a person's property. Now, there's different subsets underneath each of this in this encyclopedia. There's initiative and there's excessive. So initiative, if you initiate force against a person, if you walk up to someone and punch them, that's wrong. Well, there's also excessive force. If someone comes in and steals your sock on the table and you shoot them, that's excessive force. So each section there is divided up according to those types of categories. Well, then we talk about consent and levels of consent, enforceability, and what all that means. And then we get to membership. And there's five kinds of membership. The first is just adult membership. And that would apply to most people, to most cases. And then there is corporate membership, which is for groups or legal corporations. And then there is minor membership, which addresses basically children. And there's a lot of hairy issues there that go into it. And I actually do put in there that the positive rights of the child in certain conditions need to be upheld or provided for those who are the legal guardians of the minor. And then there's special membership for those who maybe have some kind of mental disability or condition where they can't make decisions on their own and they need legal help. And then there's criminal membership, which talks about how criminals can and cannot be treated, what rights they have, the terms for their bondage, which can be bought and sold like mortgage on the free market, and kind of things like that. So then in chapter 7 is how to settle disputes. And that talks about basically the justice process, which goes from reconciliation to arbitration to litigation and then to a jury trial. And I won't go into too many details there. And then after that are unwritten sections yet that have to do with the CCL digital network, which is basically the blockchain of some kind that will store permanent records of property titles of committed crimes, of court procedures, of, you know, property records, violations of the law and different things like that. And then, after that, some appendices and reference material. So that's basically it.
All right. So let's think about how you would take this and apply it in particular cases. Are you in contact with any of the folks out there who are trying to work on some of these micro-level startup societies, for example?
I've reached out to several. I've paid to have my emails read by Roger Ver in his free society project. I have not got a response. If anybody's listening that may help that process, that'd be great. So, I am reaching out.
Well, I'll send it to Roger.
Sure, that'd be great.
We'll get that SOB to open that email.
Yeah, you tell him, Tom. So, I am. But, you know, this is still early in the game. And like I said, we're hoping to finish up the first draft here in the next few months or half year or so. But yeah, I mean, the only big obstacle after just really hammering out this stuff is figuring out the digital network side, the technology side, which isn't overwhelming, but we're in the Cambrian explosion of cryptocurrency and blockchain projects, and most of them are going to die. A lot of them already are. And just to have a realistic perspective, we can also expect a lot of these stateless societies to fail as well. That's just the way it is in the business world. 50% of startups fail after the first 5 years. So I'm really optimistic on the one hand. I wouldn't be writing this if I wasn't. But on the other hand, we also have to be realistic and as much as optimistic. And so we can expect that a lot of seasteading projects, a lot of micronations and things like this are probably not going to do well. And it has nothing to do necessarily with the principles. It doesn't have to do with whether it can work or not. It has to do with poor execution. That's why a lot of businesses fail. And that's not something I really have control over. So I think that sort of explains sort of the efforts and the nature of what we hope to see happen. And I just think this is happening way faster than people realize. Like I was hoping that, you know, maybe in 20 years, we'd start to see the first sort of, you know, stateless thing. And it's like, well, we already have it with Royal Caribbean and like a bunch of other things. Like there's already functionally non-governmental, you know, groups and societies. And so it's just a matter of accelerating this process. And honestly, I don't think we'll have governments in 50 to 70 years purely for economic reasons, because I don't think the traditional government or nation state can compete with private governance in a globalized world. It was different 100 years ago when we didn't have the free exchange of information, when we didn't have YouTube and people can see what's going on around the world and what are places that are better to live in, what places have lower tax rates and all of that. But now, since this knowledge is just being disseminated so quickly and people realize, oh, I'm living in an oppressive state, you know, there's going to actually be an incentive for people to move to better places. And that's what I think, you know, a lot of politicians and presidents are struggling with right now. You see it with Trump, for example. He's threatened to harm the businesses who are moving overseas or whatever. And it's supply and demand. I mean, it's not something you're going to be able to stop short of building a wall to keep people in. You know what I mean? So I think this is on the forefront of it. Unlike BitNation, we don't have the tech side established yet, but we have the most important part, which is actually articulating the policies and procedures for a voluntary society that could work.
Well, it's very, very interesting. I want to make sure people have the website again. So it's creativecommonlaw.com. And when they're there, they can look over the most recent version of what you have for themselves and get a sense of it. Can they support you there in some way?
Yeah, that's a good question. You can donate cryptocurrency. This is, unlike a lot of other projects, this is not a profit-making scheme. Most blockchain nations, whether it's BitNation, it's all a fee-charging system. And this is nothing of that sort. I'm not doing this to make money. Nobody gets paid anything at this point. Obviously, we're going to have to somehow raise some funds. I'm not much of a fundraiser. I come from a family of ranchers and business owners. So if you want to make more money, you just work harder. Well, there's some things where doesn't matter how much I work, I'm not going to have enough money to make all these things happen. So, we would really like some private support, you know. So, I'm not trying to sound pious or anything, but you know, there's just some things sacrifices got to make. You know, it's like Rothbard; he could have had a professorship and made a lot more money at different places, but he chose not to because there's more important things than that. And we say that as people who are obviously pretty capitalist.
Right. So I'm glad you're doing what you're doing, and it looks great, and it's interesting, and I'm glad Norman Horn alerted me to it. So creativecommonlaw.com is the site to go to. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/1218. Well, I hope you're able to, you know, meet your self-imposed deadline with all this, and I hope we're able to crack through and get the attention of people who really need to see what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And it certainly has my endorsement for whatever that's worth. So let's you and me stay in touch on this for sure.
Yeah, and you're always, you're definitely invited on the board of advisors. I know you don't have much time, but if you ever want to participate in just to providing input in that way, that'd be great. But I really appreciate this opportunity and your support, and thank you so very much.
Thanks a lot. All right, folks, here's another way I'm going to make your life better. You ready? This is going to make your life better. It's a website one of my listeners created called Fat Loss Keto. K-E-T-O, fatlossketo.com. It is a website that has a series that walks beginners through the basics of what the keto diet is and how it works. It also includes reviews on products, recipes, books, and related fitness issues. The site is for anyone, but its creator says he has a special place in his heart for seeing libertarians succeed. He says you can advocate the non-aggression principle without looking like you're incapable of aggression. So get fit, get lean, and feel like you could bench press Rothbard's collected works. So come on over to fatlossketo.com and check it out. So very nice promo idea, but also just a good idea in general. A lot of people are interested in that. And you can check it out at fatlossketo.com, and I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1218. And you can get this kind of publicity and all my other super duper benefits to give you a nice head start out of the gate when you check out tomwoods.com/publicity and get your hosting through there. All right, if all goes well, Jeff Deist is coming back on the show tomorrow. We're going to talk about PC, and it turns out we were right after all. It wasn't just all about politeness. It was about control. How about that? Listen to us next time. Well, I don't need to tell that to you. I just need to tell that to the 99% of the world that isn't listening to the Tom Woods Show. Send the episodes to your friends, by the way. You got libertarian friends. Let them know there's a great libertarian podcast. You're going to make their lives better by letting them know about it. Tomspodcast.com is the quickest way to do that, by the way, because that has every single episode listed on the page, plus the subscription link. So Tomspodcast.com, yet another one of the neat domain names I've bought that I was surprised was available. Anyway, all right, I'm just talking too much. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.